This episode of Super Pulp Science is brought to you by Danielle Caners, and you can find me at www.daniellecaners.com.
Attention, citizens! It's time for Super Pulp Science!
This is Super Pulp Science, where genre gets made. My name is Justin Curry, my suffering-inducing host. Gregory Kmychuk is not here today. He once again double-booked himself, and so I am taking the reins and bringing you a very special podcast with a local artist, Danielle
Caners.
I was going to ask before the podcast started.
Do it again.
No, we can leave that in. Sausage gets made. who reached out to me to ask about some Comic-Con logistics, and I thought this was a great opportunity just to catch up and do it on the podcast. So here we are. Welcome to Super Pulp Science.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. So I kind of wanted to, like, before we get into convention logistics and stuff like that, I just wanted to hear a bit more of your backstory of kind of how you got into art, how you started, and how that kind of evolved into more than just a hobby and more of a business or side hustle. We don't like that word, but, like, how it evolved into something more than just a hobby.
So it's sort of been a through point in my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
Did you start? Like, were you an avid drawer as a child?
Every single piece of paper handed me to school, drew all over it. And we went into this, like, in depth last week. It was like, I wasn't great at sports. I wasn't great at academics, but, like, drawing at some point or another, people started to give me compliments on. So I think that's where it kind of really stuck for me, was like, this is the thing that I'm good at and I should keep that up.
That makes sense. Yeah, it's been a through point for me as well, and kind of the happy place, right?
Yeah,
place that I always turned, and it was never ending. There's always something to discover there.
Mm-hmm.
And I did really like sports and academics as well, in my case, but art was really the thing that was just so potent, and it just had that special something. So it's been there the whole time. But I never had any insight into how that could become a career.
Yeah, I think that's a common thing with all of our backstories is like, oh, this is nice and cute, but, like, you can't really do that for a living. So, in high school, getting out of it, like, did you look into secondary education as far as art, or like, where did that start?
Totally.
Yeah.
So through high school, apparently everyone except for me thought I should do it as a career, because everyone kept telling me that, and I was like, I don't even know what that means,
right?
And what people are actually,
what shape that takes.
Yeah, what are you actually imposing on me? But it was definitely something that was emphasized the whole way, and I chose my high school actually for art class.
Oh,
so I kind of finagled my way into a much larger high school than I was supposed to. I was supposed to go to this little rural French school.
Mm-hmm. And instead, and with instead, no art program in the rural
exactly.
school.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I moved myself into a huge school.
Intimidating and scary to do in high school.
Totally.
Yeah.
So I was already positioning myself in a way from a 20-kid class to a 300-kid class and into art school, or, you know, high school art.
Yeah.
So it was already something that I was trying to nurture. And then leaving high school, I took a year off because I didn't see any reason to go to post-secondary. I was kind of done with school in general.
No, take a break.
Like, that's enough. And I submerged myself into the health industry, actually, which is another passion of mine. And a year later decided I'm going to try art school. And Emily Carr was the only one really on my radar, which was in Vancouver, and that was part of the draw as well, was Vancouver. And so I just applied and I got in, and that sort of decided the trajectory for me. I let it sort of indicate where I should go, whether I got in or not.
Okay. And like, when we're talking about your art, dear listener, you should look up on Instagram, it's Danielle Caners just, I'm going to spell that out. Link below. Yeah, it is this hyper detailed, super surreal kind of stuff. It reminds me of Jeff Darrow a little bit. He's a comic book artist that just goes like crazy in the details, and it's really intense stuff. What kind of like art was influencing you in the early days, and like why that kind of school over something like the fine arts in Winnipeg or the graphic design program or something more commercial? Like why that direction?
That's a good question. The early influences, I didn't actually have a lot of exposure to art early on, which that saddens me. And whenever I see little kids getting that exposure, it's almost like healing to see that. And my early exposures were really comics and video games and anime.
Okay.
And there was something there that just spoke to me, and it was because it was creating a world beyond what we can see, which has always been an interest of mine. And yeah, those were the only places I really saw that happening. Miyazaki being a really big one, of course.
World building. Yeah.
Yep. Oh
my God.
So good. Eventually, I think the first artist that I saw that was kind of in the fantasy genre that's still fine art was Josephine Wahl. And she's really fantastical, like fairies decked out in color, all of that. But it really spoke to me as a first aha of what art can be, and kind of speaking to, I guess, my soul's art that wanted to come through that I didn't know yet. So it kind of was building that way. And only recently I've discovered classical art and all of that, which has really emphasized the craftsmanship that I wanted to bring. So I was drawn to Emily Carr because I thought I wanted to learn visual art, fine art, and craftsmanship. Mm-hmm. And once I got there, I realized there's more emphasis on design and illustration and those more commercial streams, like you said.
Right.
So I was going there because I thought I was going for craftsmanship. And I eventually left because there was very little craftsmanship.
Okay, that's not a dissimilar story to I took graphic design in the city here, and same thing. I was really hoping that it was going to be a little more illustration and creative based, and it was a lot more of, you know, how to get a job in the industry and how to do, which eventually started to click for me, and I was able to use it to make my art better. But I think that's coming into it, the idea you have and the reality of it it can be a bit jarring. So you moved to Vancouver for the school. Did you stay out there after, or did you come back?
I stayed there for a year and a half, and I love Vancouver. It still has a little piece of my heart. Afterwards, I was trying to figure out, okay, now what? So I just launched myself into world traveling.
Okay.
And kept going for a good year and a half. I was in India and Africa and China.
Wow.
And then I moved to Montreal for a little bit to see what's there with the arts. And it has a really cool comic scene, too.
It certainly does. Video games, too. It's a creative hub.
I had a little studio, actually not unlike this, for the first time, and it was right next to Ubisoft, I believe.
Yeah. Like right downtown.
Right down the block.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so it was just really awesome. It was those two places actually were the places that I had a lot of creative peers. It was Vancouver and Montreal. But yeah, it was a space where I was looking. Like, what's out there, and what can I really figure out? And that was the time where I started to realize what I actually want to draw.
Can you, going back a little bit to like in school, what they were asking you to draw versus like what you were hoping to get into? Just kind of describe that project that you were giving and the project that you were hoping for.
Well, I had a lot of papers to write.
Oh, really?
Which I was like, damn, that's not art.
Recite.
Oh, yes, sir. How doth the little busy bee improve each...
Stop! That is not spoken correctly.
In the foundation year, they put you in a lot of different courses, like trying all the different arts. Mm-hmm. So I was in a creative process course, which was telling me to weigh the moon.
Like how to find the muse kind of stuff?
Interpret that however you want to.
Weigh the moon.
Yes. Or no, how to weigh a dragon was actually the... There was another project about a moon. So I was in that class. I was in a sculpting class that did not teach me how to sculpt, which is why I was in there. I was in a design class. So then I'm learning design, which is completely out of what I'm doing now, but still, I think, valuable. It is good to try all these things.
It is.
In terms of actual art, I had very few projects, really. Like,
so it doesn't sound like they're teaching you how to art very much. More think about the art and...
It might have gotten a bit more focused as I went on, but I did notice a commonality in the classes was not a lot of really building the skills. They were giving us prompts. There was one class that I specifically chose offered a few perspective projects.
Yeah. Like, and I was 2 point, 3 points, like actual.
Yes. Not super technical, but there was some perspective. And that one I was really the most excited about.
That's what you wanted.
Yes.
You wanted to get some hands-on learning of how to make some art, and wasn't enough of that.
Exactly. And that was because I saw that teacher speak one time. I knew I would get something. And I just signed up for his class even without knowing what that class was.
Okay.
So that was the most valuable class.
So now you're in Montreal. We're skipping back ahead. You've got your own studio. Are you working freelance? Are you doing personal projects? What's the project load look like?
I have no clue.
No clue? Oh, you're just...
At that point.
Discovering, figuring things out.
So yeah, I went straight from being a student to being basically just a little travel bug. And although I did have an artist residency and my first book cover and album cover job right out of school, so all three were lined up immediately.
That's great.
So then that was part of what motivated it too. It's okay, let's drop out of school and start focusing on this.
You had something lined up, so you weren't just leaping without knowing. There was something that waiting for you to.
And it's work there's out. You know the glimmers of there's maybe something here. And then when I got to Montreal, I was developing an illustrated book I had started in India, actually. It was like a travel journal, very elaborately illustrated, that I thought I would publish. And so I was working on that and sort of just playing and unsure, like totally unsure of where things were going to go. There was virtually no money stream at that point. And I'm just living on savings.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
If we're not jumping ahead too far... You started doing Comic-Cons at some point. Mm-hmm. When did those become on your radar? When did those
started very early.
Yeah?
Actually, before all this.
Okay.
So I wasn't doing them super consistently, but it was the first place I ever exhibited virtually. I was 15 and had my first table.
Jeez, and Montreal, Winnipeg?
Winnipeg.
So what year was this?
Oh, 15 years ago.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Okay. That would have been like one of the very first shows.
Yeah, which I had no idea that it was the very first. But I was just, there was something that was just, I stepped into my first anime convention with my grandma because I was so excited. And then I looked around and I'm like, yeah, maybe I'm a little too young for this. And I have my grandma here. So there was something about comic and anime conventions that I really wanted in on when I was quite young. And so finally, at 15, I was able to get my first table and just made a few prints. And actually it was a really fun experience. I have no clue how much I made. That really wasn't a thing at that time on my mind.
But you were somewhere presenting your art, selling your art. And had that, like, anything like that ever happened before? Like, had you, I guess you're 15, you probably hadn't done a gallery or any kind of exhibition. So this was your first experience showcasing your art and having people pick
Absolutely.
It up. And I remember that first time doing that too. And suddenly I had a place where all those drawings could go and people actually wanted to see them. And even better, some people wanted to buy them. Like, oh my God. For me, that was like a huge linchpin in just my scale of productivity, because once I went to one show, all I did for the next year was obsess about having a much better table for the next show.
Yeah. And you have the real connections.
Yeah.
You know people are appreciating it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're doing it in person. It's not mm-hmm. like posting it online or sending it off somewhere and hoping that it gets appreciation and some of that makes it back to you. You get to be in there in person, seeing those reactions, seeing that like it's tangible. That's kind of how I figured out like what like I like to do and what people liked versus like, I'm not too sure about this and nobody seems to like this mm-hmm. anyway. So like, let's scrap that direction and follow this direction. Mm-hmm. So it really helped kind of shape the form that my art turned into. Your art's completely different direction, very different style. Did you find that as well, that the audience was helping you to kind of hone that direction, or are you still just kind of following your muse?
It's been a balance for me. Yeah, we're in very different worlds in some way, and mm-hmm. yet Comic-Con seems to still have enough commonality mm-hmm. to bring it all together. I haven't gauged a lot of my work based on the Comic-Con audience because I know I'm not directly in that niche, and I know at the same time a lot of people appreciate it there.
I think, yeah, that's, I think one of the best things about the Artist Alley is you yeah. get like art and crafts of all different types, styles, skill sets, like, yeah, people who are 15 versus somebody mm-hmm. who's worked at Marvel for 30 years are like tabling beside each other. And like, I think that's the magic of it. You kind of discovered Comic-Cons as you developed. Did you try craft sales or mm-hmm. other exhibitions? What other venues have you tried out with your artwork?
I have tried a fair bit. I have not tried a lot of gallery, actually, because my work takes so long to create. Mm-hmm. I focus more on print sales.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, I have looked at a lot of events and I've explored a little bit over the years. Comic-Con I've always dipped back into, usually at least once a year. Mm-hmm. I do women's festivals most recently, music festivals, like electronic music. Does tend to fit my genre quite well. I'm actually preparing to go to Costa Rica next
Crazy.
Month to
nice.
Do exactly that.
Congrats.
And I'll be on the road potentially for a month and a half in June, July. So this is, yeah, festivals predominantly has been really good. Craft sales, I tend not to go there as much because they're, yeah, looking more for crafts and small items typically.
Yeah, I've tried as well. I'm not what they're looking for there.
Yeah.
I catch the husbands that have been dragged there that recognize me from Comic-Con. But yeah,
it's a fluke.
But I think it's good to like try different things. Like you said, like, you know, music festivals, that's, mm-hmm. yeah, your kind of art definitely fits there. That usually probably means that you are exhibiting outdoors though, right?
Yes.
That's got to be some challenging logistics.
I make it a point that anywhere I go, I need some sort of coverage provided. I haven't invested in a big tent or anything because I don't even know if I want to deal with that with the wind and rain.
It's a collapsible anyway. Tents yeah. and you have to bring weights to weigh it down. And it's
so much. So, and I also don't want to overly stretch my sanity too. So I'm striking a balance with how much I want to work to exhibit.
Fair.
But a lot of these festivals actually have permanent galleries.
Really? So they have everything set up
yes.
for you to fill.
The bigger ones will have an infrastructure built and you hang it in kind of like a rustic barn gallery, typically.
That's cool. Nice. Yeah. That's very convenient.
And the one in Costa Rica just upgraded last year and it's got like LED awesome mandala lights all over it and this like beautiful pagoda shape and
nice.
Yeah.
For the dear listener, could you kind of describe like maybe a bit of a typical table setup for you at like a Comic-Con or a festival? We talk about the backstands and the tablecloths and all that kind of logistics as well. And a lot of the listeners are people who are getting into Comic-Cons or want to learn more about setups and you going from like outdoor events to indoor events. Like I think you probably have figured out a couple tricks. So if you could just walk us through some of your setup.
Totally. Because my work is high-end prints, that is a struggle for me because they're fragile to some degree. They're expensive and I need to hang them in some way. Mm-hmm. I've noticed in Comic-Cons, a lovely thing is all the people can make like almost like a tape wall of prints.
Yeah, the quilt of prints.
Which I can't do with the quality that I use right now.
Those print, like, they look great when you first do that.
Yeah.
They last about 2-3 shows, and all those prints are now garbage.
Okay.
I used to do that, and I hated it because it ruined the prints.
Oh.
And yeah, it's so hard to keep them nice. Some people still do it, but yeah, the quilt
the
wall.
The print wall, yeah.
The print wall.
With tape.
But I don't want to go among mad people.
Oh, you can't help that. Most everyone's mad here.
My dad actually helped me a lot with the setup initially because, yeah, I was quite young and he's a very crafty person.
Mm-hmm.
So he got excited to help me. We have a bit of a sort of build-it-yourself shelf unit that mm-hmm. I usually cover with a black cloth. And then I use magnets to hang things off of it.
So nothing's getting stuck.
Exactly.
Nothing's getting damaged.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just
these
like
are,
little earth magnets kind of
they're
thing.
They're like really strong, yeah, what are they called, neodymium, whatever, these are just really potent magnets
yeah.
that are borderline dangerous,
yeah,
and yeah,
you can pinch your fingers,
yeah,
those,
exactly
yeah.
And yeah, they're amazing, so I use those sometimes. I'm blessed at a Comic-Con, they'll have a back banner, like a black cloth.
Mm-hmm.
Last year I lucked out and they had that for me. Usually not. Eventually I want to probably have some sort of pipe set up with a black cloth myself, just if I need it. The black cloth and magnets is just so good for what I do.
Yeah.
And eventually maybe some sort of banner would be ideal.
Do you have a portfolio to people?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have a portfolio, and someone at another convention actually built me, I think like a laser cut stand for it.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It flattens
so it's a little
down.
Bit flattened. Sorry. It flattened, like it's a little tilted up. Or
It's tilted up when I set it up, and
yeah.
then it flattens down into
oh,
one
nice.
Sheet. It's just, it's so ingenious the way it's built.
Well,
yes.
That sounds nice.
I wish I could plug him. It's been a long time. I don't know how to contact this person. And then cards are, of course, important. You want those prominent.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally, your name. I haven't mastered that yet, but I have a little light up box that says Danielle Kaner's art that I'll sometimes bring. And
the lighting rigs is something that's becoming more and more of a thing I've noticed at Comic Con.
Yes.
Like people are starting to bring their own like strips of LED lights. Some people have like spotlights on their booth.
It's so intense.
It's yeah, it's getting more and more because like when you get a convention table, you're basically just given a bare table,
mm-hmm.
a bare piece of floor, and it's up to you to kind of build a little store
yeah.
and make it cozy and inviting. And yeah, that building takes time and iteration and practice. Starting out from Comic-Cons to now, you started with like half a table and now you want like at least one or two tables,
mm-hmm.
like have you scaled it all or played around with how the setup is, or has it been pretty consistent through your journey?
It's definitely scaled. At first it was hard to fill. I think I did mm-hmm. have a table the first time, like
you had
full
table to,
but it Comic-Con was new though, so
yeah.
it was very inexpensive.
$80, $40,
something
like,
yeah literally
yeah.
in that range. And probably didn't even bring my own tablecloth. Now that's a must because
mm-hmm.
you can't trust whatever.
Well, sometimes the tables are
sometimes
really ratty looking too.
Yeah.
Like sometimes they're nice,
bring
sometimes.
Bring your tablecloth.
Yeah, need that tablecloth.
So it started there, and then eventually the shelves and all that. And ideally I have two tables now.
Mm.
Sometimes I'll just decide, is it worth it or not? Because
right.
I can fit it in one, but two is ideal.
And the like your work is so detailed, I wanted to ask you about the sizes of your prints, because that was something starting out, like I would try postcards
mm.
and then 8.5 by 11s and okay 11 by 17s, and then everybody I saw was doing 12 by 18s, and it's just a little bit better, looks a little bit nicer. And then I'm, you know, always kind of struggling with people wanting bigger pieces, and bringing those is,
yeah.
is tough. But size wise, what have you landed on?
That's probably the one that I struggle with too, because I design my prints to sell online, not at shows.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the translation is sometimes a bit strange, because my prints are all quite large.
Yeah.
And I do find postcards though are really important to have, because for me, like a lot of people will see the prints and they're usually $100 or more in my case, because
mm-hmm.
they're on canvas or Giclée, like fine art cotton paper. I usually try and avoid that one because it's very fragile.
And that's, for the dear listener, that kind of printing, it's archival ink, right?
Archival,
so it's
yeah.
going to last up to like 80 to 100 years.
Yep.
It won't fade. It's above and beyond a normal mom and pop printer down the street. When you say larger, are we talking like 13 by 19, 24 by 18?
16 by 20 is a
16 by 20?
Pretty standard.
Yeah.
Some of them are bigger.
Yeah, so that's a big print.
Yeah. And I'll usually bring a few that are wrapped or framed if I can when I'm flying or whatever. That's not as much possible, but mm-hmm. It adds some emphasis. It looks good, and usually someone walks away with it,
yeah.
which is lovely.
Having one presented framed, I find it's almost like cheating. Like as soon as you have it like nicely presented, people can now, there is no hole in that imagination of what it's going to look like when it's on their wall. They want that. So having one or two of your pieces framed up, presented properly, whew.
I've been bringing easels for that.
Yeah, perfect.
Actually, Annie Stagg, I've noticed, has a really good display. If you've ever seen her pictures.
I'm sure I have.
Her work is fantastical, but also classical. She mm-hmm. does these glazing oil paints, and she'll frame each one in a really beautiful, ornate gold frame. And she has a whole wall of them whenever she goes. So, I mean, that's... Again, less travel friendly.
I was going to say, logistically.
Yeah, but it's amazing. Yeah. It looks fantastic.
So let's talk about logistics for a bit. You're, do you typically do mostly Canadian shows, mm-hmm. any American shows, any overseas? Like what's your range of shows looking like these days?
Comic-Con's usually only Canadian so far. Mm-hmm. I did do Emerald City Comic-Con lots of years ago.
Yeah.
Like I think I was 19. So
okay.
Also very early on. It was awesome. It went really well.
It's a great show.
Yeah. It was really exciting actually just to connect with that community, and the response was really good. And other than that, it's been local Canadian. I've been
mostly driving or like some flights as well?
A little bit of both, mostly driving.
What was that like the first time figuring out how to get your show into a suitcase that can go on an airplane?
I don't think I had much of a display. I really don't. That would have been when I moved back after all the traveling, which was 21, and I just made a sale.
Hey, congrats.
And yeah, so I don't think I had much then. It was mostly just flat prints.
Mm-hmm.
I might have had a little bit of magnets. I think I had like a rolled cloth and maybe a little, I probably borrowed someone's shelf and just magneted a few small prints. I didn't have the big canvases yet at that point.
Yeah. So not too crazy learning how to get it down into travel size.
But now the struggle is real.
Yeah, as that's the problem with like, it's great to expand. It's great to have enough to fill up two tables, but now it becomes okay getting that all there. And especially if it's a very busy show, like Toronto Fan Expo has like 140,000 people, bringing enough stuff to survive 4 days with that many people, it's a challenge. So what are some of the things you've been doing to like survive bigger shows like that?
Well, that's why I'm here chatting with
that's
you.
Why we're
I want to know what you've been doing.
Who's been painting my roses red? Who's been painting my roses red?
You had mentioned that New York Comic Con was on your list. Mm-hmm. And when you say it's on your list, like, you've applied? Did you get in there? I'm not sure where they're at with.
I think applications are still open,
right.
And I haven't applied yet. I just wanted to weigh out what makes sense.
Yes. Yeah. New York Comic Con was one of the first. So when I started going to American shows, I did the Winnipeg show. Mm-hmm. I did the Winnipeg anime show. And then I drove to Calgary with everything. And that was amazing. And then after that, I was like, okay, the only other big fish in town is Toronto, because Vancouver didn't even have anything. Toronto was the first big show that I went to. And it was a whole different beast, just size-wise. And then because I wasn't, like Calgary, I could drive and I could bring everything. Now Toronto, even bigger show, and I'm flying, so the suitcases became an issue, right? I want to bring enough paper, and I've made so many pieces, you know, the the more we work, the more pieces we get, and the more you want to bring, everything to every single show. And so that becomes a bit of a debacle as well of like, what am I going to cut from my portfolio, right? Like, and then to add to that frustration, people's tastes and wants change every year in every city. You might sell lots of prints over in Calgary, and then you bring that same print to Toronto and nobody there will want it. And there's no predicting, you know, like your hard hitters are not consistent from city to city, I find, and that's frustrating. So what I ended up doing for bigger shows that I had at a lot of space at, including New York, was I started printing in the cities. So that's especially for somebody like you who's doing these like really nice archival prints, and you're probably, you know, have a great relationship with your printer. It's hard to find another printer that you can trust to do that. My two cents there is printing technology has come a really long way in the last 15, 20, even the last 10 years. Print files that you send to one printer to the other, the differences are not as drastic as they were. And the other key thing here is you might notice that colors are different. Nobody else will ever be able to tell. As long as they're consistent with that print run, with that new printer, nobody's going to be able to tell that the blues aren't quite as blue or the greens are a little more yellow here than they were with your prints at home. So after doing that a couple of times, my printer graphic design brain kind of settled down a bit about, and sometimes you find like you, a lot of times you'll find a better printer in this other city that you really like. So usually what I start off by doing is getting an email together saying, hey, I'm Justin, I'm coming to your city for a convention. I want prints that are this size, this quantity. I'm looking to have them done by then. Can you let me know what your prices are and if you can fulfill my requirements of stock and size and blah, blah, blah. And so I'll send that to probably 4, 5, 6 printers around the area I'm staying. And then you'll get some quotes back. You'll get some people's coming back to you. And then usually at that point, I call said printer and have a conversation. Just again, having that same kind of, here's where I'm coming in for the Comic-Con. Colors are important for me. I don't have bleeds. Like, just kind of talk shop a little bit. And from that conversation, I usually go like, okay, I really like these guys and they seem really reasonable to talk to. Or, you know what? I don't really like the way these guys do things. I'm gonna call the next guy. And something I've done the last couple years that has really helped is I've used the same printer maybe 2 or 3 years in a row. I'll ask them if it's okay if I ship a couple things to them so they can receive them. And the couple things that I'm shipping are usually my canvases because I really like my canvas printer. So I'll ship my canvases to them and I'll ship a couple boxes of books because I also have graphic novels and comics. And I've never had a printer say no. It's usually not a problem, just... And then logistically, it makes things so much easier on you because once you land in the city, then you go to your printer and everything's waiting for you there, right? And you're about to pay them for a job. So they're like, you know, they're getting money out of the transaction. All they had to do was sit on a couple boxes. So that has been kind of my ideal scenario in other cities that are larger and I want to have a lot of stuff at. So that's kind of where I'm at. But sometimes, like I noticed on your website as well, you're doing like some really interesting prints with like holographic and stuff like that.
Oh yeah.
Can we talk about that for...
That's brand new.
It's brand new.
I have a quick question. Do you ever get a sample sent to you first just to see what they're...
Not anymore. Again, you just because like
trust
even,
it now?
Even if it's different, you're the only one who's going to notice. And like you are so familiar with your work and you stare at it all the time. As soon as something is a bit off, you know, like, oh, the blue is not quite as crisp as it was on the other prints. Like, ugh. But normal people, I'll even like at a show.
This happened with my mom recently. I was getting her noticed. I'm like, there's an issue with this one.
She's like, I can't.
look at this one next to it. I still don't see it.
So I remember I was at a show. I was at Calgary. So I can bring everything to Calgary. And I had the same print from three different printers and drastically different colors in my eye. And I showed people this, like, you want to see something cool? You can choose. Here's the same print from different printers. So whatever one speaks to you the most, you can choose. They're the same. No, they're different. Look at the colors. They're so different. No, the same
item. This is a great opportunity.
Yeah.
Like, what?
So that was a couple experiences like that, like, got me kind of less and less concerned with trying out different printers. As long as they can print on the stock you want and have the sizes you want and are not, I try to stay away from big chains. I usually just do a Google search of, like, digital printers, and I'll just find a couple websites that look decent. And after that email, I can't say I've ever had any. The biggest problems I've ever had is I'll get to the city. When I get to the printer, it's hard to see if everything's there at first. But once I get back to the hotel or the convention and see everything, if one or two get missed, most of them kind of drop what they're doing and fix that, so you can usually pick them up before the show. That's why it's really nice to be, especially with a big show, being there a day or two before.
For sure.
The worst stories I've ever heard are usually happen to my friend Drake Quirkylicious.
Like, all the time?
He uses a print. I don't
just
know.
One person?
It's always him. He, like, I'm sure other people have problems, but I'm good friends with him, so I always get to hear about them. He uses a big chain printer in the States, and the more you use them, the better deal you get. So he's got this amazing price break with them, but they keep hurting him, and he keeps going back to them. And I remember the one show it was the C2E2 in Chicago. It's a really big show, and all his prints showed up double-sided. So it was one print on one side and a completely different print on the other side. And they did his entire run like that. And he's been with these guys for years. And they just decided to print that completely double-sided. And the show he was setting up when he discovered this. The show was about to start. And so for the first day of the show, he just had to, like, which one do you want? This one, this one? Well, you get this one as a bonus.
Big Cap, I'm so excited. We never get compliments. You must have a cup of tea.
Ah, yes, indeed, the tea. You must have a cup of tea.
If you can show up a day early, that's great. And if printers screw up with stuff like that, they can really quickly fix that problem, especially digital printing. They can print 100 posters really, really quickly if they screwed up and they need to. So that's kind of my two cents there.
In terms of holographic, we're talking about the polar opposite, because each print apparently takes about an hour to produce.
Oh, geez. It's not lenticular. Like, you're not seeing different images.
No.
It's just that.
It's holographic stock. And then it took several weeks even to create the file on top of this. So the artist that worked with me, he basically blocked out certain areas so it would be printed white under it to create an opaque tone as opposed to the holograph. So then, in addition to that, then he chose which parts to build up. So certain pieces are then built up with
like
ink.
Raised.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
So it's like layers and layers of ink that emphasizes the hollow.
So you can, like, see, it's like tactile when you're looking at that print. You can see that there's something else going on. That is super cool.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that, if you want to bring those, I think that's something you'd probably have to ship ahead. That's where it would be great to find a printer, build a bit of relationship just over the phone and via email. If you're doing a big print job with them, sending them a, 24x12 box that you can also pick up, I think is completely fine.
These printers are in the US too, so that there is an advantage
there.
There you go.
So you're even saving it coming across if you're doing a big show in the States. If you're shipping things ahead, if you're not sending it to your printer, usually you're sending it to your hotel. And what I usually recommend there is just make sure when you book your hotel, phone them and tell them that you're going to be doing this, because certain cities, New York was one of them, where they asked me not to send it too early in advance. Like, we don't want to be receiving a package a month before you get here.
That's reasonable.
Yeah. And then there was another horror story that happened to a friend of mine who did a show in Florida, and she shipped her entire inventory from one show. She was in another show in the States, so she shipped everything from that show to her hotel in Florida, and they charged by the pound. So she arrived, it was like a $700 bill. Ooh. Before she had checked into the hotel, and she was able to like talk her way out of it, but it was just, you know, she didn't phone to make sure this was going to be okay, and had it been, she might have made different arrangements.
The hotel was charging.
The hotel was charging for received packages by the pound.
Wow.
I've also had another one in New York that charged by the package. So I sent like 4 boxes and it was like $10 a box. But it was just nice to know that going in. And then it's nice to talk to somebody on the other end that knows it's coming, right? I'm sending a couple boxes. They'll be here the week before. Is that going to be cool? And 99% of the time, not a problem. But it's good to know if they have weird rules or don't like taking packages or something. But
totally,
I haven't run into anything. It was just that one by the pound story that kind of scared me. So I always like to call and just make sure, and then it's just that extra bit of assurance that everything is going to be fine if it makes it.
Do you ship your display gear as well? Because you have this big like light up box and all of.
I don't bring the light up box there. Okay. No, I typically travel with the display materials with me.
Yeah.
With going over the border, as long as you don't have things to sell, there's nothing. You're not doing anything wrong. So going with your display materials, completely fine. You just let them know that you're going to Comic-Con and you have a display, but you do not have things to sell on you, and you are good to go. What else is important? Have you been to New York before?
Yes.
Yeah. What do you think of New York?
I wanted to live there at one point.
Oof. I feel like I'd get grumpy.
I don't know if I could do it now.
Yeah.
I mean, my first impression of it was just there was so much, right? Like you could find anything you want there. And yeah, I was a little enamored by it at first. And I think the arts was a piece that really struck me. It was one of the first US cities I visited and really explored the art. So of course it's on a completely different scale than Winnipeg.
Yeah. with the Comic-Con as well, I find, actually I wanted to ask like about normal Comic-Cons do you normally pick up clients and projects from the shows, and what has that experience been like?
That's a good question. I build relationships with recurring clients there for sure.
Yeah.
I haven't had a lot of jobs come out of Comic-Con, potentially because I mean, that's not really what I do as much. I don't take on commissions that often. I'm completing one right now, but it's more in the music festival scene.
You're right.
And I do them very rarely because I find, my work is so demanding and time consuming. It's hard to do jobs because I'd have to get paid a lot.
Right. To find a client who appreciates the time that you're putting into it. Yeah. It can be tricky.
Yeah. So that's not my aim as much, but definitely building relationships with just, an audience that I see year after year, or later on we interact online, or I see a sale come through. That's been really valuable. And sometimes I'll sort of get to know people over 4 years or more. And that's really, there's something special about that.
Yeah. The reoccurring, I don't want to call them clients, but like the reoccurring customers.
Art family.
Yeah, that you see time after time again. And especially with the artists, like some of my best friends are from different cities, but every, other weekend along the road, we're hanging out in Ottawa, and then we're back to Vancouver, and then over here and over there. And like we're all kind of in the same struggle, in that same fight, and lots to commiserate about. So
you've got a good posse for that too.
Well, it took a while, lovely. Right? Yeah. I was thinking about the other day, like back the first time I went to Chicago, and how I just sat in my hotel room and ordered a pizza. Yeah. And like, I don't know anybody. And I don't know how to invite myself out. And I hadn't found that art family yet. So it's great to track down people who have similar interests and have that similar drive. And it's a small pool of us that are kind of in this category, right? That found that weird space where it makes sense to do this, and here we are.
Yeah. Yeah, very similar struggles and just life views in that regard as well.
Yeah. Well, I think that's probably a good place to leave it off. This has been Super Pulp Science, where genre gets made. My name is Justin Curry. Join the fight. Make comics.